Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Today, the articles I'll be reading are from the online edition of the Smithsonian. All of them were published in March of 2025. So I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article. Why did Vincent van Gogh paint 26 portraits of a postman and his family while staying in the south of France? The artist met Joseph Roulin, a 47-year-old postal worker, in the late 1880s. The series of artworks will be reunited at upcoming exhibitions in Boston and Amsterdam. By Sonia Anderson. In the late 1880s, Vincent van Gogh spent 2 years in southern France. Though the period was famously tumultuous for the Dutch artist, it was also remarkably productive. He befriended Joseph Roulin, a 47-year-old postal worker, at the Arles train station, and their relationship became pivotal. Roulin, depicted in his blue uniform and postus hat, is now one of Van Gogh's most famous subjects. But the artist didn't stop with the postman. He painted the entire family, making 26 portraits of Roulin and his wife, Augustine, and their 3 children. It's one of the most impressive portrait series in art history, per a statement from the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. I've done the portraits of an entire family, the family of the postman, Van Gogh wrote to his brother in late 1888. The man, his wife, the baby, the young boy, and the 16-year-old son, all characters and very French. You can sense how, in my element, that makes me feel. For many years, the Roulin portraits have been scattered throughout the museums and private collections around the world. But now many of them are coming together in a new exhibition in the fall. The works will travel to the Van Gogh Museum, where they will be on view in Van Gogh and the Roulins, together again at last. Van Gogh arrived in Arles in his mid-30s, with an openness to possibility, as Katie Hansen, co-curator of the Boston exhibition, tells BBC News's Deborah Nichols-Lee. After working in the Netherlands and Paris, Van Gogh came to southern France, aiming to develop his style. Van Gogh moved into the now famous Yellow House, the home and studio in which he would paint the Roulins, sunflowers, and the bedroom. According to the statement, he didn't connect with many locals, but he found a kindred spirit in Roulin. The men drank together at a cafe owned by Marie Gonneau, who said they were like brothers, per the art newspaper's Martin Bailey, a Van Gogh expert. When the artist mutilated his left ear in December 1888, Roulin helped him recover. Following that incident of derangement, it was Roulin who took the artist home, then saw him into the hospital, looked after his affairs during recuperation, and shepherded his efforts to return to normal life. As curator Kurt Vanadeau wrote in the Museum of Modern Art in 2001, never were the postman and the painter closer, nor Van Gogh more in debt to their friendship than during these weeks. Between July 1888 and April 1889, Van Gogh completed 6 paintings and 3 sketches of Roulin. He also made 8 paintings of Augustine and 3 of each child, 17-year-old Armand, 11-year-old Camille, and the baby, Marcel. According to the art newspaper, more than half of these portraits were done from life. The exhibition illuminates the lives of the Roulins through supplemental photographs, letters, and histories. Armand grew up to be a police officer who worked in Tunisia, while Camille joined the army and served in Indochina. Marcel, the daughter, was born around the time Van Gogh met the family. As the artist wrote to his sister in July 1888, "I'm now working on the portrait of a postman with his dark blue uniform with yellow. The man is a fervent Republican and socialist, reasons very well, and knows many things. His wife gave birth today, and so he's in really fine feather and glowing with satisfaction." Van Gogh, a perpetual loner, tormented by his sterile alienation from love, likely found Roulin to be a figure of viral energy, per MoMA. The family, seemingly energized, inspired, and comforted the troubled artist, whose work didn't achieve worldwide acclaim until after his death. "They were more than just models to him," says Nienke Baker, senior curator at the Van Gogh Museum, in the statement. "With them he found the warmth of a family that he was never able to start." And that completes the article. The author, Sonia Anderson, is a writer and reporter based in Chicago. The title of her article was, "Why Did Vincent Van Gogh Paint 26 Portraits of a Postman and His Family While Staying in the South of France?" The second article is titled, "4,000-Year-Old Clay Tablets Show Ancient Sumerians' Obsession with Government Bureaucracy." The artifacts were excavated from a city dating back to the 3rd millennium BCE by researchers from Iraq and the British Museum. Another one by Sonia Anderson. In southern Iraq, archaeologists have excavated a remarkable collection of carved clay tablets, ancient records of Akkadia, the world's oldest empire. Marked with the administrative details of government, the tablets have illuminated the complicated bureaucracy of an ancient Mesopotamian civilization. The tablets were discovered in the Sumerian site of Girsu, called Tello today, settled around 4500 BCE in modern-day Iraq. Sumer is the world's oldest known civilization. During the 3rd millennium BCE, Sumerians built Girsu, a megacity, and dedicated it to the deity Ningirsu. According to the Girsu Project, a collaborative research project by the British Museum and Iraq's State Board of Antiquities and Heritage. Around 2300 BCE, the Mesopotamian king Sargon, a native of the elusive Akkad, conquered Girsu and other Sumerian cities, and he whipped them into administrative shape. Sargon developed this new form of governance by conquering all the Sumerian cities of Mesopotamia, creating what most historians call the first empire in the world. Girsu Project Director Sebastian Ray, the British Museum's curator for ancient Mesopotamia, tells The Observer's Dahlia Alberg. The Girsu Project researchers found more than 200 tablets and some 50 cylinder seal impressions of Akkadian administrators in Girsu. These clay records are incredibly detailed, showing fierce governmental oversight by the Akkadian Empire. They note absolutely everything down, Ray tells The Observers. If a sheep dies at the very edge of the empire, it will be noted. They are obsessed with bureaucracy. Written partially in cuneiform, an ancient Middle Eastern writing system, the tablets contain records of state affairs, blueprints for buildings, maps of canals, and accounts of commodities like livestock, fish, barley, cloth, and gems. One tablet lists 250 grams of gold, 500 grams of silver, fattened cows, 30 liters of beer, as conservator Dana Goodburn Brown, who is cleaning the artifacts, tells the Observer. As Ray tells the Independent's Bryony Gouch, the tablets record all aspects of Sumerian life, and above all, they name real people, their names, their jobs. The listed citizens include women, men, and children, and occupations range from stonecutter to temple sweeper. And though the Akkadian Empire was led by men, some women did hold important roles, like that of High Priestess, Ray tells the Observer. Girsu was first rediscovered in the 19th century. Since World War II, it's been looted and neglected, left open and exposed with no conservation work to address long-term stability or issues of erosion, per the Girsu Project. The site's missing or decontextualized artifacts previously made for fuzzy conclusions about the Akkad government. The newly discovered tablets, unearthed in the footprint of a mud-brick multi-room archive building, paint a clear picture. The new finds were preserved in situ, so in their original context, and we may say for sure that we have indeed the very first physical evidence of imperial control in the world, Ray tells the Observer. This is completely new. That completes the article. The title was 4,000-year-old clay tablets show ancient Sumerians' obsession with government bureaucracy, by Daily correspondent Sonia Anderson. This article is titled, How the Irish Pub Became One of the Emerald Isle's Greatest Exports. The Dublin-based Irish Pub Company has designed upwards of 2,000 pubs in more than 100 countries around the globe. Written by Lisa Weistuck. Alan Hines grew up in Kenvara, a small Irish village in County Galway. It had one shop, a post office, a church, and two pubs. When he'd go to the auction house with his father on the weekend, they'd stop in to a few pubs on the 12-mile trip home. He moved to California's Marin County in 1998 and today owns a concrete and excavation business. Seven of his nine brothers and sisters are also in the Golden State, but he says he has always felt something missing, that community cornerstone. So at 51, he decided to open a pub. The Buren House had its grand opening on March 7th on a main strip of downtown San Rafael, about 5,000 miles from Kinvara. It's next to an Italian restaurant, and there's a Walgreens across the parking lot behind the building. But to Hines, it's familiar. Where I grew up, the pub is just an intrinsic part of Irish life. If there's a baptism, they'd have the party at the pub after. Funerals, too. Everything revolves around the pub, he says. I've always been used to a small countryside kind of place, so I was concerned it would be too audacious to try to open a pub somewhere else, and the aesthetics would be over the top. It wouldn't feel cozy and comfy, and then it started to come together. When Hines talks of the pub coming together, he means the assembly of the component pieces, the mahogany bar and millwork for the back bar, counters and shelving, leather stools and chairs, decorative floor tiling, mirrors and glasswork, and knick-knacks. Each element was designed and produced in Ireland, then sent over in a shipping container. The Liscannor stone in the entryway was sourced in the Buren region, the bar's namesake. Noticeably absent are shamrock garlands, green tinsel, and leprechaun-themed anything. The Buren is one of the most recent projects of the Irish Pub Company, a Dublin-based design group that has created upwards of 2,000 pubs in more than 100 countries on every continent except Antarctica. Germany is its biggest European client, and Switzerland is a close second. In Russia, it has established 3 venues in Moscow, 1 in Sochi, and 1 in Novosibirsk in Siberia. The company's handiwork is also found in the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, Japan, Nigeria, and Mauritius, and at the New York Hotel in Las Vegas. A project is currently underway in a new high-end shopping center in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. This year alone, the company has 9 projects in various stages of completion, including in the Canary Islands and Hout Bay, a Cape Town suburb, as well as 4 under discussion. But founder Mel McNally is not in the business of just shipping pub-in-a-box packages around the world. Each one is custom designed to fit a specific space in collaboration with the local owner, who has creative control over the many, many, many details involved. The company's stock in trade is not just the Irish pub as a commodity, it's the Irish pub as a vibe. You can't sell the history and lore and memories intrinsic in a community's long-standing institution, but you can sell the craftsmanship inexplicably linked to a nation's cultural legacy. The Irish Pub Company evolved out of a project McNally did about pub design for a competition when he was an architect school student in Dublin in the 1970s. What the professors believed to be a cheeky excuse to spend time drinking pints turned into a 2-year expedition through Ireland in which McNally and some architect friends visited more than 200 pubs in cities and remote country villages. We recorded the essence of what makes a pub, in the scale, the architecture, the mix of details, the craftsmanship, McNally says. No two are the same, but they have an essence that we carry into projects we do now. That essence is anchored by the bar itself. It's the altar of service, McNally says. All activity and movement revolves around it, like electrons orbiting around a nucleus. No matter where McNally visited, how big or small or old or accessible the pub was, the slab of mahogany was the gathering zone. As such, in every bar that his company creates, the bar is visible from anywhere in the pub. It's non-negotiable. But the essence is not limited to those physical aspects. The space and decor contribute to the je ne sais quoi of Irish pubs. To go to an Irish pub, you're always welcomed in. You meet people, talk to people. That's the reality, McNally says. Lots of people try, but they don't get the essence. Developing, designing, and building out a pub takes anywhere from 4 to 9 months, from initial conversation to grand opening, and can run a client anywhere from $250,000 to over $1 million. First, the Irish pub company's designers look at the layout plan to understand the size, capacity, and flow of the space, as well as any restrictions that might be imposed by landmark associations if the building is listed on a historic registry. The customizing starts by selecting the pub style. Victorian style is modeled on the classic Dublin spots, like the historic Long Hall pub, where dark stained woods, elaborate stained glass partition panels, and shiny brass accents abound. Snugs, small enclosed sitting booths, traditionally occupied by women while their husbands caroused at the bar, are a staple. Country style, inspired by rural stone-built establishments, has paler woods and scuffed finishes that contribute to a warm, cottage-like feel. Ceramic jugs, crockery, and cast-iron kettles might be scattered about the place. The decor of the Celtic style is imbued with symbolism and characters from the ancient Gaelic folklore and mythology. Shop style nods to the old-world convention of rural pubs that double as the community general store. Shelves are lined with bric-a-brac, like antique ceramic groceries. From there, the details are selected, everything from the floor layout to bar design, including display cabinets, drink shelves, stained glass panels, joinery, and wood stains, alongside decorative lighting, glass, metal, and woodwork. The Irish Pub Company's Dublin office has slabs of wood with different finishes, books of fabric, and leather swatches. Each detail in each piece of furniture, the footpad of a stool, the piping of a seat cushion, the upholstery of a bench, is a consideration. Up to 80 people could be involved in a single project in the company's workshop outside Dublin, including carpenters, joiners, metalworkers, furniture makers, upholsterers, glass artists, and painters. In a way, you could compare it to cooking cacio e pepe in Milwaukee with pasta handmade in Rome and authentic Pecorino Romano. McNally's daughter, Anna McNally, who works in business development for the company, notes a design shift she's seen since the COVID-19 pandemic. Prior to COVID, we had more requests for a mixed modern style, which takes some traditional elements and makes them modern, with, say, a different kind of material, she says. She showed a more contemporary style of stained glass panel with crisp, clean angles instead of classic curved shapes or petal-like edges. Pre-COVID, people wanted stone as the top of the bar and timber on the front. Now people are going back to hardwood bar tops and traditional leather on chairs. They're looking more toward comfort and familiarity. Pub design is a societal mood metric. The business was kickstarted by a partnership with Guinness. In the mid-1990s, the Irish brewer was facing dwindling sales. The craft brewing scene was picking up momentum, especially in the United States. The import market was starting to feel the impact. We approached Guinness back then because we felt the concept had a value outside Ireland, says McNally. The beer company connected him with its network of distributors, and he went on a roadshow across Europe with his team of designers. Orders started coming in, especially from around Germany. The first client was in Berlin and Italy. In 1996, Fado, the first project in America, opened in Atlanta. Four more locations have since opened throughout the U.S. 1 year later, Darren Fagan moved to the city as a project manager and today runs the North American arm of the Irish Pub Company. He's worked on about 80 bars throughout the U.S., from Denver to Tulsa to Philadelphia to Palm Beach International Airport in Florida. After studying mechanical engineering, he worked as a draftsman in the R&D department at an Irish firm that designs fittings and installations for retail stores. His boss introduced him to McNally. The Guinness partnership had momentum. As Fagan explains it, by elevating the kinds of pubs where Guinness was sold, they could increase their sales, but it was the growth of the craft breweries and their brew pubs that sparked the company's marketing push. And I'm afraid we have run out of time. The title of this article was How the Irish Pub Became One of the Emerald Isle's Greatest Exports. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I've been reading articles from the online edition of the Smithsonian Magazine, all of them published in March of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available. Hopefully the one you're looking for is there. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.